Hello, Space Junkies, and welcome to What a Piece of Junk, episode 142. I am your agreeable host, Scott Bultman, and joining me is my original podcast co-pilot, Mr. Derek Marsh. Derek, how's it going?
It is going good. It is Sunday, 4:21, so, ready to embark on another work week.
Indeed, and not quite as celebratory as you were yesterday. No, but better left that unsaid. But yeah, we're here to tackle the most recent episode of Star Wars: The Bad Batch. Unfortunately, the gooey one, Mr. Dave Filoni, Nathan Miracle, is not with us. He is a little under the weather, so spare a few prayers, positive vibes, etc., for him in the Force. And hopefully he'll be back on for podcast number 143. But we are ready to talk about The Bad Batch, season 3, episode number 13, Into the Breach. So this, of course, was the episode where we got to see The Bad Batch working with Admiral Rampart to try and figure out how to get to Mount Tantus. And then Omega, never one to just sit on her duff and wait to get rescued, is working with the other kids at Mount Tantus to try and formulate their own escape plan. And she's pretty cocky, actually. She was all, I broke out of this place once before, and I'm going to do it again. And I'm like, yeah, you got to love to see kids who are positive. And, I mean, she's correct. She did break out of that place once before, although with Crosshair's help. So, yeah.
And Nala Se, too.
And Nala Se, yeah. Neither of whom can really help her this time. But I'm starting to think that perhaps Dr. Carr is going to have enough of a soft spot to help the kids out in some way. And of course, you know what? I'm jumping the gun. Let's go ahead and do the questions, because I got to talk about my... I may be telegraphing it, but question number one, what did you like best about this episode? Derek, you probably know what I'm going to say, because I've been joking about it all season. But anyway, what was your favorite part?
Wasn't a whole lot. Again, I like seeing the whole Bad Batch, you know, doing what they do best, you know, on missions that aren't like these long, huge missions. So this was nice where they had to kind of steal some, you know, coordinate plans. You know, they got Rampart cleaned up and freshly shaved and groomed. And I liked his little comments of like, he's like, what is this? This is a captain's uniform.
Yeah, I was a vice admiral. This. It's a captain's uniform. Yeah. It's like, yeah, it's not really supposed to be you. Anyway. Yeah.
And he's like, he's like, smell that dirt again, you know, and stuff like that when he's on the bridge for when they dock.
And then he's treating the other underlings like crap, and he's like, I miss doing this.
Yeah.
Like, you have had zero reformation in prison there, pal.
Yeah, so like I said, that whole interaction was quite entertaining, made me chuckle. And then, like I said, just enough where they, you know, happened to, you know, time it just right with things to be able to, you know, have the sensors off as they just miraculously land and suction onto the starship that's our cargo ship that's going to Mount Tantus right before. So anyways, like I said, but I enjoyed that a bit. It was fun with Wrecker too, of how he, like, you know, knocks out the guy.
Yeah, and then, he did his best Han Solo impersonation with, hey, can you give me a hand up here? Sure.
Yeah.
Doop doop doop. Whack.
And then they were kind enough to leave the lieutenant there back on on the dock there, you know, like he's sleeping. Like, man, that man is going to be in so much trouble. So
he's going to be an unbelievable. And then he's like, but the captain told me to let them go. And they're like, what captain? There was no captain.
Yeah. You mean the guy that was impersonating a captain that's an ex-con or ex, you know, yep, vice admiral con. So anyways, like I said, that was kind of fun. You know, again, the episode, you know, to me, like the overall story, you know, we'll get into in question two. But like I said, I did enjoy parts and bits of that one, and that was pretty much, again, at least this time the Bad Batch were part of it, right? Like we've talked about, sometimes the best parts have been without Clone Squad 99, so this time they were involved, so that was good. Yourself?
Yeah, so for me, the thing I liked best, it was, once again, Star Wars, stuffy doll, because there was a big scene where Omega recognizes her straw doll that she gave to or that she had when she was at Mount Tantus before, and Dr. Carr gave it to the little red Twi'lek girl. But all joking aside, I do enjoy that that doll is kind of like the little, the symbolism, the metaphor for Omega's optimism and hope. And, you know, when she sees that, she feels like everything is going to be okay. Things are going to work out. Now, are they actually going to work out? Who's to say? But I do enjoy a through line of this metaphor thread connecting all of the episodes. I kind of joked around about it when in the first two episodes the stuffy doll was a big part of it. But, I mean, it keeps showing up, you know? I was prophetic. No, or was that pathetic? Anyway, but yeah, it's basically been a running theme, and I enjoyed it. It was my favorite part of the episode. Second favorite part, really close, we got to see Clone Force 99 with their armor all scrubbed to be no defining or identification marks, which I think, as I saw on some other analysis of this episode, was a cool throwback to what they must have looked like as Clone Force 99 when they first started their military career, you know, because they had not yet taken the time to individualize their armor and gear.
Yeah, so that was pretty cool. Look like they're advanced, right? Like I made the joke, they look like they were sneaking in to the overall dungeon as level one noobs.
That's sure right, that, yes. So they have the cheap white quality vendor items instead of their epic loot gear.
Yes, so they had it hidden in hiding their level, right? So
yeah.
Obviously, they're all level 99, so.
Exactly. All right, cool.
Okay, but I was going to say real quick, obviously Omega can't be a Jedi then because she has attachment to physical things.
Yes, and attachment to people, in this case, the Bad Batch, and probably a growing attachment to these other children. Now, they, I think, all have some kind of force ability, which is why they're there. We know for sure that the little cat dog thing does, and I'm pretty sure the others do as well. But it'll be interesting to see if the kids can pull off their half of the scheme here. So, question two. What did you like the least about this episode?
That they didn't find Shaka Ray. Because we were supposed to be going into the breach, but apparently we didn't yet. So maybe next episode? I don't know. But
I can picture Omega telling Palpatine, release your pain. Anyway.
So, well, actually, that should be what Palpatine says, right? Release.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, Palpatine is saying that to all the Force kids because he wants to get them in part of his cult. For those of you who are scratching your heads, this is a reference to Star Trek V: The Final Frontier, where we find out that Spock has a half brother named Sybok. Man, what is it with Spock and siblings that he didn't know about? Anyway,
well, what's his dad up to this thing? Right?
Yeah. Sarek, we gotta have a talk. Anyway, sorry, wrong podcast. But they were trying to breach the barrier at the center of the Milky Way galaxy to, wait for it, find God in that movie. Because William Shatner apparently wanted to make some atheistic jingo commie pinko.
What does God need with a starship?
What does God need with a starship? What does Palpatine need with a starship since he knows how to do the world between worlds now? Anyway, that's
but
a whole different
But he's trying to find everlasting life, which in some instances is a reference to God. So,
you actually had a connection there with your literary themes. I'm impressed and also mildly nauseated.
Because it's all one big thing. If Filoni isn't ripping off Lord of the Rings, now he's ripping off Star Trek.
He's ripping off Star Trek, yeah. Actually, Dave, I don't know that Dave even got any writing credits on this episode. I'm pretty sure it's some other crew.
He might just be executive producer at
that
point.
Yeah, he's just
right?
He just was grading their papers. That was it.
But all jokes aside, like I said, it's just kind of, like I said, for the third to last episode at this point for the final season, again, it just kind of feels very anti, like, oh, we're going into the, like, what I would imagine would be a two-part episode coming up. Mm-hmm. But I know it's going
to
be
almost this one almost felt like a to be continued with its cliffhanger ending.
It did, but like I said, but it just didn't get me really that excited, I guess.
Yeah,
I don't know, because like I said, we've had mixed feelings for a while now on Bad Batch, and This season's been better than season two, but it's been such a roller coaster, hit and miss. Again, I'm really just like, you know, to your point, like Omega, you know, back to your original comments earlier, like I'm going to break out again. It's like, well, why are we even here to begin with? Right. Like, mm-hmm. did we really need to even have you escape the first time? Like, it really, to me, felt like it served no point, because as I've been watching this, you know, and it's kind of like it's never going to end, because no matter what, the Bad Batch are going to still try to rescue clones. They're still going to put Omega in trouble. And it's like, so she's always going to be in trouble. And it's just like, I don't know. I just feel
the Empire's never going to stop. The Empire's never going to stop chasing her. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Right. And they're just going to keep putting themselves in trouble. Right. So it's like, okay. So I don't know. Like I said, it's just been hit and miss. And this one's kind of like, eh. Like I said, it's got a couple funny moments and some stuff like that. But overall, it's just kind of like, okay. Like, you know, like you said, again, it upset me because it's like when Bad Batch is doing these mini episodes of heroism and their mini missions and stuff like that, I'm enjoying it, which is good because that's what this show is about. But now I'm just kind of like the overall plot storyline. Like, I don't know. Are they just going to wrap it up in two episodes? Is this going to get Mount Tantus blown up? I don't know. Right. But I hope not, because I feel like there's just so much left on the table.
I think that the way the show is going to end is that the cavalry will be the rebellion, because, you know, we know that the title of the final episode is The Cavalry Arrives. We've been joking around about it being Fennec Shand, because she's Agent May on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and they called her The Cavalry. And we joked around about it being Boba Fett, because he's Clone Alpha, so maybe he's going to show up to save Clone Omega, right? But I really think it's just going to be the rebellion as a whole. And what will happen is they will take Omega somewhere safe. We might finally get our, Star Wars Rebels is going to end with them all hanging out on Alderaan where they think they're safe. We may finally get our ending of that, where Omega goes to Alderaan and she thinks she's safe. But then we as the viewers, of course, know the Death Star looms. But then the Bad Batch will join the Rebellion proper military and become like one of the first groups of Rebel commandos, right? I think that might happen. Which would give them an out as to why, you know, why is the Empire no longer chasing them? Well, they are, but only because by virtue of chasing the entirety of the rebellion, right? For me, I think the part I disliked the most about Into the Breach was kind of what you said, the pacing. It felt like it was a much longer episode than normal, even though it really wasn't. Because they kept hopping back and forth between Omega's stuff at Mount Tantus and the Bad Batch stuff at the Imperial base at freaking Coruscant, for crying out loud. Boy, we crack on Clone Force 99 for their OPSEC, but my gosh, the Empire is just lackadaisical to the extreme. You can't capture an escaped Khan and three of the most wanted war criminals at the homeworld? Like, you're at the capital? Although, I guess that's kind of a Coruscant tradition, because General Grievous and them raided the capital during the middle of the Clone Wars.
Well, and the thing that always makes me funny is, like, you know, there's stupidity of the Empire that nobody notices how big Wrecker is. Like, they're not going to, like, it's not like if he's not wearing, you know, trooper armor. He's literally wearing trooper armor and he's twice their size, but they don't think anything odd about it, right? Like, yeah, that's
just I've always wondered if this is a really deep cut in joke about that one stormtrooper who's way too tall in episode 4 when he bangs his head on the door on the Death Star. Like, so at some point there's just policy of, and there are about 10% of troopers that are 40%, 30% taller than every other trooper. It's like in Warhammer 40K, when every so often in the Imperial Guard, there's an Ogryn, which is basically an ogre in space. It's like a human from a human settlement planet that has been a human colony for like 500-600 years, but it's in some highly irradiated solar system, or it's an industrial world where there's lots of toxic waste because the whole planet's a factory, and they mutate into these big ogre looking things. Yeah, but yes, the secret of the ooze. But they still are expected to serve in the military because, you know, the draft is a thing, even if you're 7 feet tall and 500 pounds. And so they have special suits of armor, or sometimes they don't, and they just stitch together two regular suits of armor.
It's like a mid-rip.
For them, Two exactly. Their bellies are hanging out, and they have the big, their sons out, guns out, Sarge. And so they, you know, they're off doing ogre things, and they give them specially created Ogryn guns that are basically giant revolver grenade launchers, like from,
I ain't got time to bleed.
Exactly, yes. Anyway, so there's 10% of the Stormtrooper Corps are the really tall ones. That's why nobody notices Wrecker. That's my new headcanon. He's the Ogryn portion of Star Wars.
But doesn't the Empire hate aliens anyways?
And mutants. And to be fair, over in Warhammer 40K, you know, burn the mutant, kill the heretic is like part of their slogan. And I'm like, well, what about rattling snipers and Ogryns? And they're all like, you are a heretic. And I'm like, okay, I'll stop asking questions.
When it serves the military purpose, it's okay. But when it's against it, everything else is bad. So
yeah, well, totally. And this episode proves that because, yeah, we hate aliens, but we sure do have a group of alien kids that we're trying to clone for the Emperor over at Mount Tantus, right? When it serves our purpose, we love them. But most of the time, we just are teaching you to hate all the foreigners. Anyway, I mean, aliens. I'm sorry. Did I say foreigners? My bad. Anyway, my complaint, the thing I hated the most about this episode was the pacing. It was just too much back and forth. I would have liked the Bad Batch segment to be the main story, and just one story this time around. Because every time we had some super high tense, high stakes infiltration moment with Clone Force 99, then we had to switch back over to Mount Tantus where Omega and the kids. I mean, supposedly they were having very tense, high-stakes infiltration kind of stuff with their escape plan, but it just didn't have the same effect. And it felt like their stuff, the kids' stuff, was slowing down the clone stuff.
Well, and what was weird, too, about it was that when Omega has, like, the vial thing come in through, like, the side wall, and it takes that and takes the vial, I'm like, why is that in her cell? Why would they design a cell to do that? And then on top of that, then when she pulls it out, it's like, oh, it's just a huge elevator shaft, right? So we're going to drop cookies down here. And it's like, that's the worst design ever to put something in a cell for somebody to escape when all it takes is a little, you know, screwdriver for them to knife.
It's the dumbest of dumb waiters. You know, it's like, why is this even here? I'm reminded of Galaxy Quest once again, when they get down into the ship's bowels and there's all the chompy jaws and the floaty stuff. He's like, why is this even here? Anyway. Okay, all right, question number three. What connections did you draw to the rest of the Star Wars galaxy?
Well, I feel like we've connected every other sci-fi and fantasy out there so
That's
far.
Right. Now we have to find some actual in-universe connections to this particular franchise.
So the biggest one is obviously the landing claw, right? The landing claw trick. But the weird thing about it, though, this isn't like some huge ship that is a Star Destroyer and the Millennium Falcon's hiding on it. It's literally... like maybe 2-3 times the size of the ship that they're doing.
It's like this, like half of the science vessel is covered up by the shuttle. And like, how do you not? I mean, I get that the proximity sensors were turned off, but how do you not notice the extra mass?
Does that not like kill the literally like destroy them when they go into hyperspace? Because you would think that the way hyperspace would be for the engines to pull it and to have something like, let's say, even 33% more mass and everything else to pull it, it wouldn't be able to do it. It would like just like start to do it, and then like halfway through it's going to run out of energy and just, I don't know.
So I think that, so we often think of hyperspace as working like warp speed, in that you have to have enough energy to bend space around but really it's taking a shortcut through a tunnel. So I feel like once they bust open the wormhole to get into hyperspace, it doesn't matter how much energy they had to have to open the tunnel.
But then this would make the Holdo maneuver completely stupid.
Well, possibly. But what I'm saying is when they should notice it. Now, again, hyperspace isn't as clearly defined as warp speed. Like, warp speed in Star Trek has had, like, you know, scientific theses written about it. Hyperspace is whatever they need it to be to tell their story. So theoretically, when they would notice this would be when they try to leave hyperspace. Because when they have to cut a hole back into real space, they'll need more energy because the extra mass of the Bad Batch ship. So it'll be interesting to see if that actually happens next week on the next episode. I don't think that it will, but
Would it be cool if they like they jettison out and push the space science vessel and that blows up or something because it can't make the gap. Yeah. So,
but speaking of the Holdo maneuver, it would still work with my theory. It's just that Vice Admiral Holdo set the tunnel entrance to be behind the flagship. So she like went super fast to punch a hole in through the tunnel to and then collided with all their ships. Whereas the science vessel, and most of the time normal hyperspace entry, you do it right in front of your ship so that you don't need as much energy. But she didn't care because she knew she was about to die.
Anyways, it's still silly and stupid, but that's a reference of the landing claw there, because you've obviously already referenced Wrecker and doing his best Han Solo. Or I guess it'd be Han Solo doing his best Wrecker, since that only comes after this and the same thing. So I guess Bad Batch is the first one to do it, I guess, technically, even though it's 45 years later.
Wibbly, wobbly, timey, wimey stuff. Oh, that's another sci-fi franchise. My bad.
Yes.
So my connection is Omega and the kids are basically doing the Andor thing from breaking out of Narkina 5 with Kino Loy and friends, because she's sitting there all those days planning some kind of prison break that involves her captor's hubris, and they're overlooking this one particular thing. Once again, this one particular thing that is related to bringing us food or water to ourselves. So in Andor, of course, the key was getting the water onto the floor so that they could not be, you know, electrocuted by the guards with their bare feet. Ah, just so creepy. It's just absolute psychological terror with, you know, you have to have your feet, your shoes off as you're a prisoner. Talk about degrading and demeaning. Anyway, that's a whole different episode. So I felt like I was watching almost a clone, yes, a prototype of Andor's whole thing where they're trying to escape from some Imperial compound. And it's like, if I didn't know better, I feel that Omega is the long-lost sister that Andor has been searching for. And the reason he's so good at breaking out of prison is because it runs in the family. But I know that Omega is not his sister. Or do I?
Well, no, because they were born on a different planet, right?
So, yeah, that could. Yeah, the ages don't work out either.
Yeah. So, but no, but it would have been great though, actually, if they had done a little bit more time pass. Like, I feel like three seasons and like Omega's quote unquote matured, but I don't feel like she's grown up like physically. Like, I wish they changed her hair a little bit and all that, but I really wish they would have done a little bit more with her physical appearance.
She's only a teeny tiny bit taller.
Yeah, I guess maybe she's filled out, but like, I don't know. I just wish that they would have done a little bit more with that just to make it seem like, oh, it's been a few years at least, you know, she was 11 or 12 and now she's, you know, 14, 15 or something like that throughout this course of time. Cause otherwise, like I said, it's kind of like, yeah, this has all been about, you know, 8 weeks, 2 months, right? I don't know.
Yeah.
The overall three seasons,
12 months.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like that, but again, missed opportunity, because that's, again, one thing that brought Andor, you know, a bit more realism, because you had that countdown for his time. So you definitely at least knew a little bit, right? Even though maybe necessarily the characters didn't physically look too much different, other than a couple of them did appear to be older, a bit more.
And of course, there was, at the beginning of this season of The Bad Batch, when Omega was first at Mount Tantus, we got to see her do her best Rey with the tally marks, the hash marks, for how long she'd been at Mount Tantus. But this time around, we're not getting any sort of clues like that.
No.
It reminds me of one more sci-fi franchise for the bonfire here. On an episode of Babylon 5, Captain Sheridan gets captured by the evil human forces, and they're interrogating him in this, you know, nondescript, almost totally dark room where he stays. And when his interrogator comes in every day to start asking him questions, which he, of course, valiantly refuses to... There are four lights! Anyway, he valiantly refuses to answer. And he basically, at one point, Captain Sheridan tells the interrogator guy, you know, I realize that, you know, that they've got to be close to being able to rescue me because my destination was only X number of days away from Babylon 5 space station. And you've held me here for 12 days. And the interrogator guy is like, what makes you think you've been here for 12 days? And he's like, every time you come in that door and it opens, I can see the sunlight. He's like, you think the light outside your room is the sun? And he walks out into the hallway and flips the light switch off and on, off and on. And he's like, you've been here as long as I tell you that you've been here. Because there's no windows, of course, or any other way for Captain Sheridan to tell the passage of time. And it's just another piece of a psychological puzzle to try to break him down. Which I was just like, oh, that's insidious! Because the writing on Babylon 5 is just unbelievably good, as the kids say. And so I thought about the... Now, the special effects on Babylon 5, not great, but that's okay. I thought about that when I was all, there are no windows in this room where the kids are. They really don't ever leave that room on Mount Tantus, or at least they're not supposed to. And the only way that the children could keep track of the passage of time is every day they're given or taken another blood sample from them. Because we see Dr. Carr... No, we see the other female clone come walking in to take Omega's sample this time around. It was basically like, it's time for your daily sample, you know. I guess they could also try to track time by the meals, but, you know, even that can get kind of wonky.
They have them sleep every day. They put them to sleep, so it's not like they have to sit there. It's no different than what the shift that they're working or whatever, right? So they work their shift and, you know. So, but again, the stupidity of them is that, oh, Omega's already escaped, but let's put her in with the rest of the people. It's like,
right?
Yeah. At least credit the...
She should absolutely be, like, frozen, or if not frozen in carbonite, at least just sedated all the time.
Yeah.
Or, you know, put in one of those crystals if that doesn't kill you. I wasn't clear about, you know, the amber crystals that Obi-Wan saw. I don't know if that kills you or not. Anyway, whatever. They should put her in some way that she cannot interact with the others.
At least chain, like have her in binders, right? Like, it's not going to, you know, I don't know. It just... seems dumb the way they've set it up, and it's like, obviously I know Carr is something behind her, right? And it's at least nice that a couple people are like, we don't even trust the head chief scientist, right? Because we know she's a clone, you know, that's whatever, grown up and blah blah blah. And it's just like, okay, so
yeah,
but I'm sure it'll be some plot armor going on these next two episodes. So
yes But I think that Omega is still going to be able to pull off the escape because, you know, a tiger can't change its stripes. And speaking of which, a tiger can't change its stripes, question number 4, do you think that Admiral Rampart is going to somehow double-cross the Bad Batch?
I feel like he already would have done it when he was at Coruscant. Like, to me, it's like, he'd been like, you know, here, Lieutenant, hand me your data pad so I can check something. And then he, like, types a message, right? And, like, it just missed opportunity. So, I mean, I'm not saying he still won't because, again, plot armor. But to me, it's like, why? Again, they can't kill you in that sense because they're not, it's no difference than, like, Omega. Omega could just tell the kids, they can't kill us because they need us for their science, right? So they can just go off and do whatever, right? And that should be the same thing like here with Rampart. Like, if you kill me, that's fine, but I'm your only connection before they kill her or do whatever they're going to do. Like, it's supposed to be like time sensitive, I'm guessing, right? Because they were on the final verge of what they were doing with Omega, and they're using a breakthrough, which again to me was stupid. That's like, okay, if you know her blood sample works, why do you need to put her with the other clones?
Yeah, just make copies of her. Actually, why do you even need her body now? Just take her red blood cells and start making copies of them. I mean, you guys
drain her completely, right? At least drain her.
Oh God, yes. It's like Grogu, where they're when we first saw him and he was on the when we first saw him get recaptured by the client and they've got him and they're like literally draining him out of his blood, you know. But yeah, like, you guys have the technology from the Kaminoans to make copies of entire people. Surely you can clone red blood cells. We can clone red blood cells right now on Earth in the 21st century. Anyway.
It was technically a long time ago, so maybe that's the one thing they're missing.
That's true. Then again, I think I'm all, dude, it's so simple. You just put the thing in the thing and hit the copy button, make 12 copies. Like, it's a giant Xerox machine. And maybe that does work, but it doesn't transfer over the midichlorian thing that they're wanting. Oh, wouldn't that be an interesting wrinkle if at some point, like Echo or somebody corners Dr. Hemlock and they ask him that basic question. Why do you even need Omega? You can just make copies of her blood sample. And he could be something like, we cannot copy midichlorians themselves. You know, that would be interesting. That's why you can't make a Force-sensitive clone, because you can't copy. Ooh, anyway.
Then why would they be Grogu?
Yeah, why would they? Well, maybe by that time, Moff Gideon and them have figured out a way to copy the... Well, yeah, because Gideon was all like, I finally made a clone army of myself with Force powers.
Or maybe he needed Grogu because he's actually the Force-sensitive. Maybe they still have Omega's blood to work, and they just need the Force-sensitive now.
Because they lost all the samples from the kids. Because I still think that Dr. Carr is going to help double-cross the Empire in some way. Will.
Yeah, the female girl will catch on, and she'll try to stop Dr. Carr, but Dr. Carr will kill her / stun her. And Omega and the kids will make a final push. And then, you know, they'll be reunited with the Bad Batch. And the Bad Batch, that'll be the, you know, and then Hemlock will cut them off right at the end of this episode coming up. And then episode 15, like you said, the cavalry arrives. So blah, blah, blah. So they're on the run. And then all of a sudden, here comes Wolf and Rex and maybe Boba and Fennec Shand.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I'm all for a big finale battle, of course. I think that Admiral Rampart is going to double-cross the Bad Batch, to get back around to my own question 4 here. Because the reason I think it's going to change, because you were like, why didn't he do it already at Coruscant? Well, at Coruscant, there's layers upon layers of bureaucracy, and he is a wanted man. But I think he will... you know, sneakily, deceptively tell himself, okay, we are at Mount Tantus now, a super secret Imperial base where Dr. Hemlock does a lot of off-the-books stuff. So if I turn over the Bad Batch to him and then appeal to his conspiratorial nature, maybe I can convince him that I'm useful enough for him to secretly put me on his project here at this super secret base where nobody's ever going to come and report me for being a war criminal or a criminal. And I can get away with it because this dude is all about secrecy and, you know, as long as you're useful, I will keep you around, even if I have to keep you off the books, like he did with Cad Bane. Hemlock did with Cad Bane. Now, I don't think that's going to work for Admiral Rampart, but I think that will be his logic, and he will actually say something along those lines to Dr. Hemlock when he's all like, these aren't my troopers, they're dun-dun-dun, the Bad Batch. But then Dr. Hemlock is just going to kind of be like, no, you're stupid, and then, like, kill him immediately.
Yeah.
That's my theory.
Very well.
All right. What do you got for question 5, Derek?
So, we've kind of gone into it a couple times already, but will Omega and the kids break out before the Bad Batch arrive? So, Scott, what are your first?
I think that they won't. I think it's going to be one of those comedy of errors. Wait, like the Bad Batch is going to run into the cell or the central, you know, laser gate vault and be like, surprise, we're here to rescue. Where'd you guys go? And like the kids will be like in the ventilation shaft thingy-ma-boop that Omega was talking about when right as the Bad Batch arrives. And then they'll be like, oh, you're here to rescue us. Great. And then, you know, they'll all run out together. They'll all escape together. But we'll have a moment where it's very much, I'm Luke Skywalker. I'm here to rescue you, you know.
But Wrecker will be too tall to be a stormtrooper.
Yes. He'll bonk his head on the door to the vault. Oh, man, if that happens, I'm going to have to rewind it because I'll fall out of my chair laughing so hard. Anyway, what do you think? Are the kids going to escape before the Bad Batch arrives to Mount Tantus?
Yeah, like I was mentioning before we were recording, yeah, I think what will happen is they'll use the whole, you know, duct and escape through it, and they'll get out, and then they'll get stopped by the Dr. Carr, like, where do you think you're going? And then the other doctor will, you know, or whatever, scientist will stop her, and they'll have to battle off or whatever, and then the kids will escape. But they'll still be like somewhat in the compound, but they'll be outside the building. And then all of a sudden, you know, here comes the Bad Batch. But like I said, there could be a point when, you know, Rampart and them and Bad Batch are coming, and then Rampart, you know, does his backstab. Like, I feel like there's going to be like 6 backstabs in the next 2 episodes.
Three per episode.
Yeah. So who's who? Like, okay. And it's just going to be like, all right, who's it this time? I feel like that's going to be what we happen to have. What we have, because I mean, otherwise, I feel like, again, they're putting too much focus on the kids escaping, and it's like, you know, and going back to Star Trek, it's like, here's the Rascals episode, right? Where
yes.
So a little bit of TNG on that one. So yeah.
Good times. Good times. Well, I did not want to leave our discussion of this episode without mentioning one little... We've had so much sci-fi interweaving that I have to mention this, even though it's somewhat controversial. Everybody, please send your hate mail to whatapieceofjunkpod@gmail.com. So earlier this week, at my beloved Warhammer 40K universe, the company, Games Workshop, published a snippet of a new book that includes a paragraph or two of a short story about a member of the Adeptus Custodes, the elite of the elite when it comes to Imperial fighting forces in Warhammer 40,000, helping to guard and fight against bad guys. And for the first time ever, the narration explained that this particular Adeptus Custodes super soldier was a woman. And so, of course, as you can guess, all the neckbeards and non-neckbeards were in a huge tizzy because since the 1980s, there's been this feeling that Space Marines, granted, Adeptus Custodes are not the same as Space Marines. They are actually above Space Marines. Just had to say that for all of my really, really picky grognards out there. Have always famously been only male. Now, there's a lot of reasons in lore why Space Marines have to be male. Not all of those reasons apply to Adeptus Custodes. And Custodes aren't necessarily clones, although some of them have been. But the point was, you had this very famous, you know, essentially clone warrior army that heretofore had been an all-boys club. But the company wrote that story, Games Workshop, as though female custodians had always been there, we just didn't really talk about them before now. Rather than having it be some major revelation, which I think would have been a cooler, narrative. But anyway, and all I could think about was how, here in the Bad Batch, we've seen female clones are now bopping around at Mount Tantus, whereas earlier, Omega being a female clone was like a really big deal. But now we have these adult-sized female clones in a force of elite warriors that heretofore had been an all-boys club, and several people in the Empire, actually most of the people in the Empire, just sort of act like the girls have always been there, we just didn't talk about it. And I found it so weird.
Or the
weird
fact that they trust them. That's the thing, too.
Yeah. Yeah,
like, and why I found would you it so trust any of them?
So weird that these two things of the there have always been girls in as part of our clone force happened in the same like month here in real life in my two biggest fandoms right now. Actually, they're probably my first and third. Star Trek's still bigger than Warhammer 40K for me, but anyway. I was like, wow. Talk about the cultural zeitgeist, specifically super soldier women clones. What? Anyway, I blame the internet and how it proliferates the same idea over and over and over. All of these stories brought to you by artificial intelligence, coincidentally, totally outlawed in the Imperium of Mankind in Warhammer 40,000.
Please, somebody got it right.
Yeah. So anyway, I had to bring that up. If you guys out there listening want to complain or rant or, you know, give me the thumbs up, whatever. But yeah, if you feel like there are more female super soldier clones in your day-to-day routine than there were last month, you are correct.
Well, we just know why they make all these girl clones, though. They're really good at science. The boys are good at shooting weapons, but the girls are good at science.
See, I want to be able to tell you that, no, Derek, you're being stereotypical. But that's what at least the Star Wars girl clones have been teaching us. Because Omega is decent at fighting, but she's really, really clever. I mean, like, this little girl can figure out stuff super fast, right? And then, but now, I will say, over in 40K at least, the Adeptus Custodes female, she was just as competent militarily as any of the other Golden Boys.
But she was trained, you know. So.
Oh, gee, raised from birth to be, ultra-killing machine.
That's what the Kaminoans were doing, right? They were using... Because obviously they can control it, because it's not like, oh... I mean, other than a few defects, which makes sense, but the women or girl clones aren't defects. They literally, switched the chromosomes or added it, whatever the science term that they could do for cloning for it, to make them girls, because they probably needed them, one, to help them. Because were the Kaminoans dying out? Was that the whole reason they got into cloning?
Gosh, is that part of the lore? I want to say that there was a book back in the day that has now become legends that talked about how the Cabanoans were dying off. And speaking of legends books, we've got an interesting topic to discuss after our break. But Derek, I don't want to cut you off. I just, that was just a really, really, really great segue.
We can lead right to it. And speaking okay, cool. of other sci-fi IPs,
that's right. Speaking Kevin... of other shows, check this out, you guys.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. Here are the other great shows on the Fandom Podcast Network. Culture Clash, where we discuss the latest in entertainment and pop culture. Blood of Kings, our show covering the entire Highlander universe. Couch Potato Theater, we celebrate our favorite movies. And Time Warp, our fandom flashback show discussing a year in movies and our favorite retro movie, TV, and pop culture topics. Good Evening, discussing all things Alfred Hitchcock. Hair Metal Podcast, we cover the rock metal music of the 80s and early 90s. Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, discussing the time-traveling Doctor Who universe. Lethal Mullet, an action film podcast, covering the 80s, 90s, and beyond. Also, check out the Lethal Mullet Network for more great podcasts. What a Piece of Junk, our Star Wars podcast. Making Treks, a Star Trek podcast, with a deep dive into the final frontier. The Fandom Show, our Fandom Podcast Network live YouTube show discussing the hottest topics in fandom. The True Believers MCU podcast, discussing the Marvel Cinematic and Television Universe. Union Federation, our Star Trek and the Orville show. And we're proud to welcome the BQN Network to the Fandom Podcast Network. Please visit our friends on the BQN Network, a Star Trek Universe podcast that also includes your favorite topics, movies, history, superheroes, and more. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network on YouTube. The Fandom Podcast Network is also on all major podcast platforms. Fandom Podcast Network audio master feed is on Podbean at fpnet.podbean.com. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can email us at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.
All right, great. Thank you so much, Kevin. Just real quick before we bop off of the Bad Batch, we had theorized earlier about, did Dave Filoni write this episode at all? And the answer is no, it was Brad Rau, who has been writing, I think, almost all of the episodes of the Bad Batch this season. So there you have it. It was not, in fact, written by Dave Filoni. And you could tell, because he has his own style, like most authors. And that is an excellent transition into our new topic here, which is the 15 best Star Wars books of all time. Derek found this listicle from our friends at Screen Rant, written by Daniel Tenaglia. It was from just 2 days ago, as of the date of this recording. So April the 19th of 2024 was when this list came out. But it is not limited to books from the current canon. It includes books from the Legends designation. So a lot of the novels that I grew up reading and read in college and after high school, and a lot of books that Derek has read in the past as well, will be on this list. But it's a really good 15-book list, with some that are really, really old and some that are less than a year old. So, Derek, this was a great choice of topic from you, so I'll let you take it away.
Well, you were mentioning it. Did you know there's 605 Star Wars books, 359 in Legends, and 246 in canon?
I knew that there were several hundred. I would not have been able to answer that trivia of 605 Star Wars books. My goodness. I thought I had read pretty good number of them, but I've not read anywhere close to that.
Well, and 246 in canon. So it's like, I didn't realize that. I mean, what's Disney had now? 14, 15 years of Disney? When did they buy?
No, wasn't it 2012?
Was it 2012? So 13
years?
Yeah,
so we've had... That seems we've had basically 13 years, 12
so
years.
So they got to be counting like maybe like comic book franchise, like, you know.
Oh,
like...
yeah, there's a whole little section here of the chart in this article from Screen Rant that talks about fiction books, original novels, adaptations, junior novels, junior novel adaptations, game books, and then young readers' books.
Okay, that's why I missed the breakdown here. So, yeah, because, I mean, that's a... A ton. Young readers' books is 93, so that's a ton of, I guess, the I guess it would be like a bunch of the Golden books that they've done. Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing.
Other things.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's interesting to note the Legends segments have 22 game books. So I'm thinking that's like RPG source books and that sort of thing. But in the new canon, there are zero game books that are considered canon. Well, so your stuff from Force of Destiny and Age of Dark Rebellion Forces. And that kind of stuff. Yeah, not canon, even though it may have been published, you know, less than 10 years ago.
That, yeah. Or maybe, because even then I'm just trying to think, yeah, I mean, it's a lot there. So anyways, yeah. So obviously several of these I have not read or listened. So not going to be able to talk a whole lot from personal experience of whether I liked it or not. But we'll start the first one from 15, and this one's really recent, like you said. Just came out July of 2023, which they have a lot of Delia Dawson on here, which, you know, come one way or another. But, you know, with the Rise of the Red Blade Inquisitor. So it's obviously a canon one. The thrilling backstory of a Jedi turned Inquisitor. So it's really about the story of Askat Akaris. Apparently he had some items between Anakin Skywalker at the time, and then it goes through, I don't want to obviously, you know, go through it, but obviously it's nice because it says gives an intense glimpse into the dark side. So it goes a little bit deeper, about how, you know, some of the Jedi or Padawans fell into being, dark side Inquisitors.
Yeah, and we don't want to give too much away because, like I said, this is less than a year old, so no spoilers here, but I will say that praise for the novel has included other reviewers saying, Inquisitor, Rise of the Red Blade is dark and intense, feeling almost like a companion for Matt Stover's novelization of Star Wars Episode III, Revenge of the Sith, and it is hard to think of a higher compliment. The Revenge of the Sith novelization, of course, has been praised many times on many book lists about, as one of the best Star Wars books ever, and of course, it is an adaptation of one of the best episodes of the Star Wars film series in the Skywalker saga, which with being Revenge of the Sith. The reviewer here writes as a coda, this is a stunning glimpse into the dark side written with skill and flair. So hats off to friend of the show, Delilah S. Dawson. I, of course, am a big fan of hers. I have her book Phasma from the sequel trilogy era that talks about the origins of Captain Phasma as a character. And even got the chance to, when I lived in Charlotte, to meet Delilah at a book signing and got my copy of Phasma autographed by her. So thank you very much, Delilah Dawson. Maybe someday I'll be able to convince her to come on the show so we can interview her about it. She did do a bumper for us back in the days when we did more bumpers, which I probably need to adapt them into the video so I can start weaving them into our YouTube era, but that's a project for another day.
All right, number 14 was The New Jedi Order, The Unifying Forces by James Luceno. It's obviously a legend. The head title for this one is The Avengers, Endgame of Star Wars Legends. So this came back out in 2003.
And the cover.
Yeah.
Poster and the cover definitely feel like Avengers Endgame. Like everybody you can think of has a headshot on this brilliant wallpaper background looking thing.
Did they get them to sign their autographs? And
That would be awesome, especially for the ones that were never portrayed by any living actor. You want to know how old this book is. So first of all, it has the Star Wars The New Jedi Order imprint. But there's a little starburst on the cover that says, contains a bonus CD-ROM.
And what is that like on the cover across from them? Is that an alien? Looks like a snap-faced orc with his jaw ripped off?
Maybe this is one of the Yuuzhan Vong. So the data box for this says the stars of this novel are Luke Skywalker, Jacen Solo, and Jaina Solo. So this is, of course, during the time frame where the Solo children are the major focal point of the Force in the galaxy. And Luke is still there doing Jedi Master things. And, of course, there's a gorgeous redhead in this drawing who is Mara Jade, because this is a spoiler alert for the turn of the century. This is before Mara Jade gets killed. And so Luke is there helping to lead the new Jedi Order. And yes, this is indeed a story of the Yuuzhan Vong in the synopsis.
Luke in his
here.
Slick back hair, too, in that.
Oh, yeah. He's looking like a badass. Anyway, This chronicled the galaxy's war with the Yuuzhan Vong, the blurb says, an extra-galactic race, that means from outside the Star Wars galaxy, kids, who worshipped pain and were immune to the Force. So in other words, it's Jedi versus Edgelords. Matters came to a head in Lucino's The Unifying Force, the grand finale, which culminated in the climactic battle of, oh boy, Yuuzhan Tarr, the Yuuzhan Vong name for the recaptured Coruscant. Luciano is a master of continuity and weaves the many plot lines and cast members together skillfully. Like, no joke, you guys, if you find this article, the graphic for this has 8 main characters. Talon Card, I think that's Talon Card, Lando, Leia, Han, Mara Jade, Luke Skywalker, Jacen Solo, and Jaina Solo. All of them across a gigantic cover. It absolutely is the Avengers Endgame of Star Wars New Jedi Order. Because
I like, if you scroll to the sides a little bit with it, you can see some of the other illustrations there. And these guys look like they're kind of like scrolls meet, I don't know, like the,
it's like scrolls meet
Naga.
It's like scrolls meet Cobra La from G.I. Joe, the movie in 1986, because they used biological technology instead of synthetic technology, and the Yuuzhan Vong look like they have bio weapons. Like, dude's got a snake staff that is an actual snake. You know what they look like? It's orcs meet the Jem'Hadar from Star Trek.
Well, and they look like vampires / zombies in the next one after that, where it's got all three of them lined up. And it's kind of cool that they're like dragon spears, or like living creatures, but they're using them as actual spears. So.
Yeah, it definitely reminds me of, there's a scene in G.I. Joe the movie that Cobra Emperor Serpentor pulls one of the snakes off of his backpack and then rakes it across the thing's spine to make it turn into a spear, just like this guy from the Yuuzhan Vong, it looks like he's doing with the snake. And then he hurls the snake at Duke and it pierces his heart and supposedly killed him, but then because of the death of Optimus Prime causing such a huge kerfuffle in
Hasbro
Transformers
totally
the movie,
Hasbro
actually retconned this and added a overdubbed line at the end of the film, or in that scene, saying Duke has gone into a coma. It's our nephew,
it's
Duke.
Duke
has gone into a coma. And then at the end of the film, there's a scene where somebody says over the radio that, oh, Duke's going to be okay. We're definitely not killing one of our heroes, because the parents will come and burn down the studio.
So
anyway.
But did they do a comic book adaptation of this? Because the next picture after that's definitely a comic book.
I bet they did. And the heading here is The End of the New Jedi Order. In The Unifying Force, Luciano brings together so much of the EU for this final installment in the longest Star Wars book series ever. He's a master of referencing even obscure EU details, and because of that, this book is an incredibly satisfying read for Star Wars book fans. One of the best finales in all of Star Wars media, The Unifying Force is a masterful must-read for fans, but probably only after they've read the 18 books preceding it. So if you want to get your Wheel of Time on, but you prefer Star Wars, you want science fantasy, space fantasy instead of medieval fantasy, go read The New Jedi Order. So you've got 19 books worth. Eat your heart out, Brandon Sanderson.
You could do it all this summer. I believe in you guys. So.
Oh, yeah, geez. Well, you know, nowadays it's super easy. Absolutely, it's super easy to do with either audio or just download them all to your iPad. You know, you don't have to actually hunt down each individual volume unless you're just that crazy to buy a bunch of physical media. Who even does that? Anyway, All right, number 13 is Kenobi by John Jackson Miller. Now, this is also Legends category, which is really weird because the publication date is July 29th of 2014. But apparently Miller was working on this before Disney completed the purchase of Lucasfilm, and so therefore it was washed away as they threw the baby out with the bathwater somewhat back in the day. Kenobi was published long before the Obi-Wan Kenobi Disney Plus TV show was even a twinkle in Kathleen Kennedy's eye, and it told the story of Kenobi on Tatooine. The author of this article says it's a fan-favorite novel and tells a very different story than the TV show, focusing more on Tatooine than other planets. And it is a much smaller and simpler Obi-Wan tale. And it's very character-driven than more so than the galaxy-spanning adventure tale that we got in the Disney Plus series, which I loved Kenobi as a Disney Plus series. But I have always heard really good things about this novel, but that explains why, even though it's relatively new, only about 10 years old, and it came post-acquisition when it was published, but it definitely was worked on before the new version of Obi-Wan's time in exile.
Yes, so... and it'd be interesting. I never read this one either, so it'd be interesting to actually read this and compare them then and be like, yeah, they should have took this one to script, or no, this one wasn't as good as what they ended up producing. So
it definitely would not have been as much of a spectacle. Like, there wouldn't have been the, you know, the
Vader wasn't involved with the Inquisitor.
And Vader was not involved. Yeah.
But again, I'm all about good stories. So if it's a good story, I'd rather have that. I don't need... Don't get me wrong. Again, I appreciate everything they've done with Hayden Christensen, especially since we're still now wanting live-action Clone Wars. So,
yeah.
All right.
I'd say, Derek, you have some weird artifacts on your camera there. That was weird. I think it was the light.
Yeah, it was a weird glare.
Derek's dematerializing. Wah, 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 wah.
Speaking of Endgame, so... All right.
Yes.
Lost Stars by Claudia Gray is number 12. It's the Romeo and Juliet in the original trilogy era. Just like Romeo and Juliet. So this one's canon, like we said. Set over the course of 16 eventful years in the Star Wars timeline, Lost Stars tells the story of two ordinary citizens in the galaxy whose love stories turn apart by the Galactic Civil War. So I don't go into too much because, like I said, I don't want to give these books away, but it definitely has a interesting premise. I like the idea not dealing with Force and, you know, having to be part of the rebellion, or I mean, there might be some connections to things, but, you know, always even had to be part of the Empire or the Rebellion, unless if one's a rebel and one's an Empire, and then you have that whole, you know, two families together against each other. So but otherwise, it says Gray's beautiful Lost Stars may technically be a young adult novel, but to many readers it is a higher quality than most other Star Wars books. So.
Yeah, it's absolutely the a tale of two houses, you know, here in Fair Verona, but here in the not so fair Empire. But to me, it also had a little air of the American Civil War in the USA, where you had literal families and couples torn apart because one side was rebelling against the other that they considered to be a tyrannical empire. Yeah. And so, yeah, I think that one's really good. This one is canon. Just came out in. Well, I say just September of 2015, almost 10 years old, but it still has the banner across the top, Journey to Star Wars, The Force Awakens. That was when Star Wars books of any kind that were being promoted as tied into the new film, but before the film was actually released, they were selling hot and heavy. Like this novel, as well as Phasma and many of the others at that time frame, were just like selling out all the time. It was amazing. As a time of Star Wars
came
making
out
a
after,
bunch of
though,
money,
didn't it? I thought that came
I
out
thought
before.
It was Journey to, the, I thought it was Journey to the Force. You know what? I'll look it up in a second.
I think Phasma came
list.
Out after once we all were kind of like, oh, who's this silver, you know, plated?
Maybe it was trooper. Journey to Star Wars: The Last Jedi, because they liked to do that during the. Phasma is on this list, so we'll check it out when we get down there.
So, all right, cool. So number 11, I, Jedi by Michael Stackpole. So this is Legends. An X-Wing pilot becomes a Jedi. So we got an adventure that is, not about Luke, but this is about Qorn Horn, which we all know. So especially since we've talked about him quite a bit just in Legends EU canon out there. So. So this is more about the backstory of Qorn Horn and how he became what he was, right? As he was part of the Rogue Squadron under Wedge Antilles, and then what he does in going training under Luke Skywalker through his kind of first person, telling of the story. So this is really cool. It says, I, Jedi, really brings together the often separate military and Jedi sides of Star Wars books and is a great read for any Star Wars fan. Did you read this
and
one?
Important. I read portions of it because, of course, this came out in 1998, right in the wheelhouse of my hardcore Star Wars fandom for the expanded universe.
And it came out on May 4th.
It did, too, even though we didn't do that back then in 1998. But, you know, but this was when I was hot and heavy into all EU things, as I had a major crush on Mara Jade, and of course, I was also heavily playing the Decipher-era Star Wars CCG, and all of these EU characters being made into cards for the game were usually very powerful cards, so I wanted to find out more about the characters, and so I picked up all the comics, novels, and video games. And this was also very recent, or very close in time, to the whole experiment of Star Wars Shadows of the Empire, the movie with everything but another movie. And we didn't think we were going to get prequels at this time, y'all. So when they did Shadows of the Empire and all these novels, we were like, oh, well, this is the closest we'll ever get to another Star Wars movie. So we got to snap it up. Oh, how little did we misunderstand. Anyway, it was a really good book. And it was very fun. And Corran Horn is a great character. And his wife is Mirax Tarek. One of the other major light side characters in the Galactic Civil War era. And so this is also a distinction of a Star Wars novel that's written in first person. As a author who enjoys writing pulp action in first person, I was heavily influenced by this and Mr. Stackpole's writing style. So up next is number 10, Shatterpoint by Matt Stover, which is also Legends, but it is Mace Windu's Clone Wars novel. So this tells the story of what Mace was doing during the Clone Wars, at least the parts that we didn't see in the Clone Wars series and film. The Clone Wars multimedia project ran from 2002 to 2004 and told the story of the Clone Wars across multiple mediums, most notably at that time in the original cartoon series, The Clone Wars, but the really short-form one from Jendy Tartakovsky on Cartoon Network. And so Shatterpoint is a deep character study of Mace Windu. And of course, Mace has famously mastered that particular force technique that is called Shatterpoint, which is what he used to help attack General Grievous at certain points, even when other Jedi found General Grievous to be quite impenetrable. Your lightsaber will make an excellent addition to my collection. Cough, cough, cough. And so Mace Windu was like, I don't think so. And this is the story of how his former master, Depa Balaba, is lost on a mission to Mace's home planet of Harun Kal. This is pretty much the major Mace Windu novel. Gets high marks here from the author of this article.
Yep. All right. So one that we have that's going back to a little bit more recently, back in March 2nd of 2021, so right after COVID, so maybe the person was writing it while they were quarantined like the rest of us, It is a Victory's Price by Alexander Freed. It's an Alphabet Squadrons finale. So this one is part of the Alphabet Squadron trilogy, which I didn't even know was a thing. I don't know, did you know that Alphabet Squadron was a thing?
I did, but only by virtue of the fact that it was, again, part of the whole, you know, road to Star Wars, the Rise of Skywalker, or what have you, you know. The Alphabet Squadron stuff actually had books come out in between 7 and 8, and then also between 8 and 9, if I remember correctly.
Gotcha. And this would have been after the final twos. This is the final show, our final part of the trilogy, so.
Yes. And of course, it's even though they came out as part of the background for those films, the action for Alphabet Squadron did take place during the Galactic Civil War. And this story is specifically the Battle of Jakku and the end of the Galactic Civil War. Because as you guys may recall from other stories, Jakku was kind of the last big hurrah for the Empire. Even though Palpatine had been killed at Endor and Vader gone, and Death Star 2 destroyed, you know, they still had Super Star Destroyers and whatnot. A major portion of the Empire's power was always the Galactic Fleet. And so the Imperial Warlords that still remained, you know, they were very much using that to their advantage to try and keep order and keep what was left of the Empire together as the Rebellion continued to grow in strength and try to aim for making a new Republic. Because just because we saw those people pulling down Palpatine's statue on Coruscant doesn't necessarily mean that everybody was all like, well, I guess since the Emperor's dead, we give up. Let's go back to being, you know, nice democracy. Yeah, no, that's not really how that happens.
Yep. So, Well, and they snap a shot of it from Battlefront Star Wars, the video game. So that mm-hmm. has, I know, the reenactment as part of the one of the missions and scenery that you can do is the Battle of Jakku. So, all right, that's kind of cool. All right, yeah. This next one here is number 8, where we're actually getting into the new High Republic era. Mm-hmm. And this one is the first one that's on the list here at number 8, Light of the Jedi by Charles Soule. The High Republic yep. begins. Actually, so this one, I don't want to read too much into it because I've actually downloaded this on my Audible.
And I have the hardback right over there somewhere. So I would like to tell you that I finished it. I haven't finished it yet, which is terrible because I've had it for
like... Did you get past chapter 1 at least?
I've had it for like 3 years. I think I've gotten into chapter 3. I have found the description of the, you know, the major peril that they have to deal with. I'm way behind on High Republic stuff. I told myself that I was only going to do novels because trying to do novels and all the comic books and all the other stuff, just too much. This is kind of like a new millennium version of Shadows of the Empire, where they do a whole lot of interweaving storytelling across multiple mm-hmm. media with a focus on books.
But they didn't give us new CCG or they didn't give us a video no. game yet. So
No video game. That would be cool. A High Republic video game would be cool. And I actually think we're going to get a bit of a wink and a nudge about the High Republic when Star Wars Acolyte premieres later this year, because the timelines are somewhat close to each other. Acolyte doesn't take place in the High Republic era itself, but it's close to the High Republic
era. Yeah, it takes after the High Republic. So when the yeah. Grand Republic is starting. So we probably should get some mention of it. So that'd be cool, finally. We got, 6 more weeks, I think? June 4th or something? Or is that...
Yeah.
Because May 4th yeah. is the Empire Tales. So,
yeah, okay. Tales of the Empire, yep.
All right. So number 7, Phasma by Delilah S. Dawson, the First Order Captain's Backstory. And we've talked about this. If you want to go way back...
way back to one of our earlier,
maybe in the top, like maybe first 20, 25 episodes, I think.
Oh man, something like that. Cause I read this book not too long after it released in September yeah. of 2017. It's a really good book. And as you could tell from my, my review way back when, I won't read too much of the author's the writer's review here because I have my own thoughts about this book. I've actually read this one all the way through. It's a good story. Delilah always, you know, has a really good yarn. But it almost felt like it was a different sci-fi franchise that they added a few Star Wars elements to. It feels a bit more like almost a Mad Max kind of novel because the planet upon which Phasma is growing up is very much in a post-apocalyptic wasteland kind of thing.
I like Delilah S. Dawson, but I did not care for this book. Mm-hmm. This one is very, just felt like 100% it was just ripped off of other stories. Specifically, you mentioned there about Mad Max. It ripped mm-hmm. off Avatar. It ripped off Dune. It ripped off, you know, just there was a bunch of just, you know, all over the place. I think there was even a scene where it was ripped off of Alien or the Alien franchise, I feel like, when they were getting attacked by something, I think that covers their face and sucks their water out of their body or something like that, like facehuggers, if I recall. Mm-hmm. Yes. Overall, just like I said, just wasn't something, I did the Audible like I did back then because I do Audibles the most things nowadays because I just don't have the patience for reading when I travel because I get motion sickness. So Audibles are great for that. Like I said, every time, I don't know, I didn't feel like it was one of her original works, the way yeah. she tells stories. And I just felt like this one was almost kind of, I felt whether she wanted to write about it or not. I don't know. I just, like I said, it just felt weird compared to her other. It wasn't like some of her other stuff where it seems to be more original characters and content. Obviously, mm-hmm. there's a lot of original characters in this as it's the background story to Phasma. But again, I just felt like it was kind of, maybe she just got voluntold that she needed to write this. I don't know. So
maybe the charitable, more professional term for that kind of thing, rather than saying it was a ripoff or even an homage, we call it a pastiche. It's when you're trying to sort of ape the style and topic and atmosphere of some other famous writers or works. And so this was very much a sci-fi pastiche of a lot of all those things you just mentioned. Of course, I like all those things you just mentioned. So I took this book to the beach. I took this book to the beach when Mita and I went on vacation to the Outer Banks and pretty much read it in one weekend. It was a nice beach read. I had a good time with it. It did not, however, make me want to learn more about Captain Phasma after reading it, because she was almost a generic strong female warrior orphan character. Most fun part for me of this book was the interlude near the end where we find out how Captain Phasma got her famous armor and where it originated from, which I won't spoil here because it's pretty cool if you guys want to read Phasma or just Google up that section about the origin of Phasma's armor.
And I'll be the opposite. I actually liked the first couple of chapters when it was just her and her tribe. I thought that was more original, and I felt like that was a better thing with her versus where it eventually leads to her. And I don't know, it just made it really upset me because it's like Phasma was like more heroic character and then she just became bad, which I don't feel like it really, I don't know, maybe it propped her up too high and then her fall was just too heavy without having enough heaviness to bring her down. I don't know if I'm conveying that feeling right where it was really noted.
Origin didn't have enough gravitas for you to accept her becoming essentially dark side.
Yes. Then on top of that, too, what really pissed me off was because I think I read this or listened to it after The Last Jedi, I think, and I already knew she died. So it was like, okay, well, this is pointless. Or maybe that's why I was pissed off at The Last Jedi after that. I can't remember. It's like, well, they just killed off the character that had no meaning, just like they did Snoke. So, and it's like, all this cool merchandise, and she dies. So, anyways, enough on that one. So let's jump to number six. Darth Bane, Path of Destruction by Drew... How do I say this?
Karpyshyn.
The End of the Sith. And
This is definitely Legends. It's from 2006. And talks about Darth Bane and how he's the Sith Lord responsible for establishing the rule of two. So, of course, Darth Bane is one of the most important Sith Lords of all time. And this is his legend story and is the first book in the Darth Bane trilogy.
I do like that they do reference the lost episodes that Darth Bane appears in the Clone Wars series when he appears in front of Yoda. So that's cool. So,
And our author of the article here at Screenrant says, by the end of this story, the Sith Brotherhood of Darkness is gone, and the pattern that would run on to Palpatine is established. This is an essential read for any Star Wars fan who likes the dark side or the Sith specifically. Now, Derek, I haven't read this, although I do know a pretty good amount of Darth Bane, amount about Darth Bane and the whole Rule of Two thing. Have you read this?
No, I have not. I have a couple of, I have Bloodline, I have that, not that one, and that one I do have, and do not have that one. So I have like three out of the next six for us to do. So I don't have this one yet. So.
All right. Well, speaking of upcoming ones, number five is Bloodline by Claudia Gray. This is a canon novel set in the years before The Force Awakens, and it is subtitled here in the article, Princess Leia's Darth Vader Tragedy. So this is the book that tells the story about what happens when the galaxy at large finds out that Leia is the daughter of Anakin Skywalker and also that Anakin Skywalker was Darth Vader. So Leia made a bid to become Chancellor of the New Republic, but her career came to an untimely end when her opponents publicly revealed that Darth Vader was Leia's father. Spoiler alert from Return of the Jedi, you guys. Bloodline is a very unique book, our author writes, with Claudia Gray given tremendous room for world building. It's set 6 years before The Force Awakens and fleshes out the politics of the New Republic, some groundwork for what would become the First Order, and even the very beginning of the Resistance. It is skillfully written with Gray's perfectly capturing Leia's character, and anyone who wants to see how the galaxy of the sequel trilogy came to be really needs to check this out. One ding against this book is that it was essentially a book about politics. And, we all have heard the prequel trilogy get such criticism as, the negotiations about trade routes just don't make for a compelling story, which is
But Andor has proven that wrong.
But yes, but Andor has proven that you can make political intrigue in the Star Wars galaxy an interesting and even compelling story. So I think that Claudia Gray does the same thing here in the printed word with Princess Leia, of all people, as hopefully, as proto-Chancellor Leia, but definitely as General Organa.
Yeah, I started this, I'll be honest, I started it, got through the first chapter, and then I ended up getting sidetracked with something else. I never got back to finishing this from the Audible. So I'll have to go back because, like I said, it's like, oh, that came up. So and now that, like you said, we've seen Andor, cause it's been a few years since I've downloaded this one. So but I'm looking forward to revisiting it.
Yeah, check it out, you guys. All right, number four, the granddaddy of them all. If this one wasn't so great, we wouldn't have all these hundreds of other Star Wars novels. Heir to the Empire.
I don't know why this wasn't number one, I'll be honest. So
I don't either. Heir to the Empire by Timothy Zahn. Of course, Legends now, but this was the thing that kept Star Wars alive back in the 1990s. Release date, May 1st, 1991. Good Star Wars stories come out in May. Come on, Disney, get with the program. Star Wars Heir to the Empire is, of course, Grand Admiral Thrawn's first appearance, and it tells us what happens in the galaxy far, far away after Return of the Jedi is over, and Luke, Han, Leia, Chewie, and all of our friends find that there is still a galaxy to save and a war to be won, because the Empire will not go quietly into that good night. And Grand Admiral Thrawn is the guy to come back from the Outer Rim to lead a resurgent Empire to give our heroes the greatest test they've had in quite a while. It is impossible to overstate how important Heir to the Empire, the beginning of Timothy Zahn's Thrawn trilogy, really is. Best sentence in this entire article from Screen Rant, and absolutely true. It reinvigorated the Star Wars Expanded Universe back in 1991 and introduced characters whose impact endures to this day, most notably Grand Admiral Thrawn, but hopefully someday soon, Mara Jade, who's become Thrawn, of course, a major villain in canon in the Ahsoka series on Disney+. In Legends, Heir to the Empire is the story of a unified Imperial remnant making a desperate last push to overthrow the New Republic, pretty much the same story destined to be retold in the Mandalorian era. And we very much expect that to happen. So if you guys want to get a little bit of a foretaste of what might occur when Grand Admiral Thrawn actually shows up and takes command of all the leftover Empire forces, check out Heir to the Empire. And of course, Dark Force Rising and The Last Command. So that's part two and part three of this story.
This one is so good that I just recently spent my, I had like 6 credits on Audible, and I spent 3 to re-download this, just so I could listen, because I obviously read them a long time ago, but now I want to have Mark Thompson read them to me, so.
Yeah, totally. You know, the author of this article here on Screen Rant finishes up this by saying, looking beyond all the character debuts, though, Heir to the Empire captures the magic and feeling of the original trilogy in a truly special way, making it a must-read for all Star Wars fans. Zahn is an excellent author. He's really good at pulp fiction, and so you can tell that he has that background, because he writes these very episodically. There are cliffhangers galore, femme fatales, excellent action scenes, huge space battles, wonderful set pieces, all of it in the way that George Lucas was doing, as they both tried to ape Alex Raymond and Flash Gordon. So, you know, I would, man, now that I think about it, Flash Gordon is rumored to be getting a renewal itself. I really hope somebody out there lets Timothy Zahn write a Flash Gordon book as a tie-in for the new Flash Gordon stuff. Oh, yeah, that'd be so great. I'm going to manifest this out in the universe here. Come on, guys, make this happen.
Real quick, though, as you were reading that last sentence, Scott, did you think that Easter egg there and the way they were spelling looking?
Oh my gosh, I think that's a typo, but if it's not, that's great. Because Heir to the Empire, of course, was written before the prequel trilogy was ever even thought of by most mere mortals. Perhaps George had thought of it. If you, depending on which interviews you watch from the 1980s, George had already thought of the prequels and the sequels back in 1976.
He technically said he wrote all 9 chapters.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, and then of course, Mark Hamill famously gave an interview where he was all, after Return of the Jedi, and he was all like, you know, I told George, you know, I'm up for working again, but I, you know, gotta at least take a break. And he's like, but I think the next story is going to be about before Luke was born, so I'll never play Luke Skywalker again. Har, har, har. Anyway, so, but yes, this typo is LOOKIING. In the Heir to the Empire universe of clones, you can tell someone is a clone of somebody because they have the same name, but they have extra letters in their name to show that they're the duplicate. So when Luke Skywalker gets cloned in Dark Force Rising, spoiler alert, it's L-U-U-K-E, Luke, as we used to call him, to prove that he was the bad Luke instead of the good Luke. Which in and of itself, the whole storyline culmination of why it's important that we have bad Luke is just so great. I don't want to give it away. I know this was like 30 years ago, but oh man.
There's still maybe some young listeners out there. That
oh, absolutely. Know. You guys out there, go
we
read
make
this.
The joke about Ezra all the time on here.
That's right. That's right. anyway.
So, but this is where it all right, began. No. So.
Absolutely. This is where it all began. And I would love to have seen a movie version of that type of Clone War. Not armies of clones, but rather, oh no, we've copied Anakin and now he's going to go and try to fight Obi-Wan. But then Obi-2, because remember I told you about how we used to say Obi-Wan, he's like a clone. He's a veteran of the Clone Wars. He was Obi-Wan, and then he had to fight Obi-2. Anyway, all right.
But Obi-2's a real life. They can't do that because that's his brother's call sign, Ewan McGregor.
That's right. Yep. So. All right, Derek, number three on our list. What are we speaking of threes, what do we got?
Well, speaking of threes, yes, we are going back to movie three, which you mentioned earlier, which is The Revenge of the Sith novelization by Matt Stover, who's appeared before on this list, the stunning companion to episode three. So I'm guessing you read this, or did you not read this? Because I never read it.
I read pieces of it. I want to say I read the whole thing, but it's very much the really good Star Wars book. The writing here by Matt Stover is just amazingly well descriptive. I follow a lot of Star Wars and writing accounts on Threads and Twitter or Sitter or whatever we call it now, Instagram. And often this book will be touted as an example of not just one of the best Star Wars novels, but one of the best science fiction novels of like the last 20 years. This, of course, came out in April of 2005. And the scenes at the beginning that segue into the battle over Coruscant that we see when General Grievous is capturing Chancellor Palpatine, they're just so good. I remember a piece of this book. I don't even have to look at the screen because it's not on there. I'd have to dig it up to make sure I quote it verbatim. But it basically says that the people on Coruscant watched the news reports as it looked like Palpatine was going to get captured and possibly killed when Anakin and Obi-Wan come screaming out of the stars to save the day. Everyone sort of knew that this was the final moment of glory for the Jedi Order, because even if the Republic wins the war, they're not going to be the same as they once were, because now they've had to be generals and admirals in a big galaxy-spanning conflict. But if this is the end of the Age of Heroes, then by the Force, we have saved the best for last in Anakin and Obi-Wan. Whoa, come on, guys! You want to go read the whole book right now?
Well, and there's also one because the fun thing that people do with these short little videos that they do on TikTok, Instagram, and Facebook, people will read excerpts from this and they'll put a layover to the video. And there's one where it's talking about right as Anakin defeats Count Dooku, and Palpatine then, at the time as the Chancellor, tells him to kill him. At that moment, then Count Dooku realizes he was a puppet and a toy this entire time, and he was all for the layout of this one standing in front of him for his journey to the dark side. You know, obviously that's what, you know, they're saying Count Dooku realizes in that matter of a split second before Anakin slices his head off with the two lightsabers. So so I was like, ah, that's pretty cool. You know, when they're pulling it from the excerpts and all that stuff from the novel. But but at the same time, I just never, I guess, had a super interest to it, because the problem is that it's like, well, this is better than the movie.
Yeah. And it's kind of like I already know the story. Like, I know how this book's going to end because I watched the movie. I've watched it many times. But as our author of here at Screen Rant says, written in a much more mythical and flowery style than many other Star Wars books and sci-fi, this novelization makes the fall of the Republic and the Jedi Order feel truly epic. Stover focuses his narrative in on Anakin and Obi-Wan even more than the movie. He skips over all the stuff that's happening on Kashyyyk. And there's a repeated maxim that's, this is what it feels like to be Anakin Skywalker, a line that becomes increasingly powerful as the story continues. The novelization is arguably the definitive way of experiencing the story of Revenge of the Sith. When Episode 3 came out, there was a little bit of complaint about how it just didn't feel like it gave us enough of meat on the bone of how you could be like the Sir Lancelot of the Jedi Order in Anakin, then fall so hard to become, you know, worse than Mordred himself as Darth Vader. Like, how do you go from Lancelot to Mordred in one movie? And the answer is, well, you don't really, but if you want the more in-depth and epic mythological version of that fall.
Read, kids, read.
Read this book, kids. Read this book.
Well,
good
then,
words. That's where Stover, ideas are born.
There you go. Can Matt Stover write the novelization of Attack of the Clones?
That novelization is in a whole different galaxy and not in a good way compared to Revenge of the Sith. I'd like to see him write a novelization of The Rise of Skywalker. Come on, Matt, really challenge yourself. You took Revenge of the Sith and turned it into a masterpiece. What can you do?
If you really want to challenge him, write the novelization of Aftermath.
I'd like to point out that there are, in fact, zero parts of Aftermath on this list.
Not even an honorable mention.
Nobody talks about He Who Shall Not Be Named. It doesn't understand prose. Anyway, all right, number two, Darth Plagueis by James Luceno. Now, this is also Legends, Palpatine's Master, and the Phantom Menace. So, of course, this is the story about the guy that trained Palpatine as a Sith. Briefly mentioned in Revenge of the Sith, Darth Plagueis the Wise was Palpatine's Sith Master, whom he killed. And while never actually appearing in the films, Plagueis is one of the most important characters in the entire Star Wars universe grand scheme. As Darth Plagueis by James Luceno reveals, he was behind all the events of The Phantom Menace and was incredibly important to Palpatine's backstory. So this book is basically the real beginning of the Skywalker saga. And even though it's Legends now, Darth Plagueis has been mentioned, obviously, on screen in the films, and has been mentioned a couple of times in other places as well. And this is basically the capstone to the prequel era, and also probably the capstone to the entire Legends EU.
Yeah, this one I downloaded recently, too, so I'll be listening to this at some point, so...
Yeah.
Looking
okay,
forward.
And Derek, what is number one?
So we are, again, Matt Stover here, so good on him. And we are returning back to the New Jedi Order. This one is Traitor, the Tortured Journey of Jacen Solo, a.k.a. what Ben Solo should have been.
Yeah, I was going to say, kids, if you're all like, wait, Han Solo betrays the Jedi Order, Han Solo's son betrays the Jedi Order, that sounds so familiar. Well, guess what? That wasn't a super original idea. This book came out in July of 2002, and Jacen Solo is, of course, the main character, and it's the story of how he falls to the dark side.
So, yep, it's... takes the first place on our list, the 13th book in the New Jedi Order, so you got to read the other 12. Consider it the best Star Wars book ever written. This tells the story of, I guess, Jacen, because he's got another misspell here. So apparently he's the other looking was not an Easter egg. So
no,
a young Jedi Knight, the son of Han Solo. Yep. Taught by the ex-Jedi Verguri at the hands of the Yuuzhan Vong. A poetic masterpiece. Okay, so it's the crown jewel. Yep, so as Verg tortures and teaches Jacen, the Force and those who wield it explored on a philosophical level like never before. The meaning of the Jedi, the Sith, the light and the dark are all questioned, picked apart, and put together in a way that changes the entire Star Wars universe. It certainly helps that this intense story is written by the incredible skilled Matthew Stover, making Traitor an absolute pleasure to read. If you pick up only one book on this list, make it this one. But I feel like that is a bit misleading, because if there's 12 other books leading into this, it'd probably be very confusing.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, if you're a Star Wars fan, though, the idea of Han and Leia having a kid who's force sensitive and you know, kills all the Jedi Order, you can grasp that pretty well.
Yeah, but
I feel like...
But you'd have to know it's Legends, though, right? Because if you're a Star Wars fan of today, you would have the 9 films and everything else. So I feel like you'd have to help yourself by building the new world around you to be able to grasp it. I'm not saying you couldn't, but I don't know. I would just feel like you'd want to have that. Especially if you didn't grow up during that time.
Yeah. And fair warning, if you do decide to read Jedi or New Jedi Order Traitor, this book ends on a real downer because, you know, the story doesn't reach its point of redemption, which is a key part of really every really good Star Wars story, until later in another book that we've already mentioned on this list, and that being the Avengers Endgame of Star Wars Legends. Way back up at number, I don't know, what was it, 8, 9? Anyway, the one where like, everybody shows up to help stop the Yuuzhan Vong. Because the Yuuzhan Vong are the big bad in Traitor as well. And in fact, they're part of the reason that Jason falls to the dark side. Even though they themselves are not really involved in the Force, they're still about, you know, questions of good versus evil. That's the Unifying Force is where that was the book, number 14, back up at the top of this list here. So yeah, if you want to read it, go for it. I would suggest that you read The Unifying Force as well, just because that way you can realize that, oh, wait, our heroes do actually save the day eventually. But yeah, I think it's interesting that they put this as number one. I have not read this book, but I know about it from some various synopses over the years. And of course, because of course I wanted to know, wait, how does Jason become a bad guy? I would have put Heir to the Empire at number one on this list myself. Because like I said, it's sort of like when people ask me, what's your favorite Star Wars movie? I always say, I'm picking episode 4, because if it wasn't so great, we wouldn't have the others. And I feel the same way about Heir to the Empire as a novel. If it wasn't so great, we wouldn't have 600 and something more Star Wars books over the years. I could be wrong. Lots of people like to tell me, oh, they would have made a sequel to Star Wars even if the first one was garbage because it made so much money. And I'm like, dudes, it made so much money because it's not garbage.
Well, and you have to remember, too, for all the movies, Lucas had to put it up himself. He didn't. Mm-hmm. He had to spend all that. Where do you think he was getting all that money to make episodes 1, 2, and 3? It was from all the money he made in the 90s. Right, in the 80s, from the toys and all that stuff, he didn't have that money. I mean, obviously, I'm assuming somebody would have given him something to make the movies, but they could have been completely different. They could have been worse. They could have been better. Who knows? But it's interesting though, because if you scroll just a little bit further down, they can do the fan vote, and guess which one was number one by a large amount. Almost 50% of the fan vote is at 44%, which is 197. Which, granted, isn't a ton. But not, again, everybody, one, is going to read Screen Rant and really care. Because, again, this is a person's opinion. Two, to go all the way through and scroll down and be like, oh, I'm pissed off. I'm just going to close this because Heir to the Empire wasn't number one. But then if you vote, you'll know that Heir to the Empire was 44%. Revenge of the Sith, actually, Path of Destruction at 12%. Revenge of the Sith and Dark Plagueis at 11% each. And then Traitor at 5th at 5%. And then everything else was 1 or 2%. So there you go. Well, so the fans have spoken. Right. Heir to the Empire.
Well, thank you, my fellow Star Wars novel fans. I think that's also an important distinction. The only people that are going to vote on this poll are people who are fans of Star Wars novels, not just Star Wars fans. Because, you know, we have so many breakpoints of, oh, I love Star Wars, but I only watch the movies. So I don't watch the cartoons. Or I watch the movies and the cartoons and the live action, but I don't read anything. I read all the stuff, but I don't play the video games, et cetera, et cetera.
Or I read the young adults or the kids' books and all that other stuff.
Yes. Right?
There's a lot of those have unique stories, too, in themselves. So.
They do. I'm a huge Star Wars fan, but I only collect action figures. I don't watch the movies. What?
But I just noticed this, and this is how I usually leave us with another question for another time. But it's interesting that Jason Solo, and it's spelled the same as Jason Syndulla.
Uh-huh.
So do you think...
I don't think that's a coincidence. Yeah, okay. And I also don't think it's just oh, that's how we spell Jason in the Star Wars galaxy. Because I actually have seen people talk about this online before, and one guy's answer was, you know, one guy was all, oh, it's Filoni with an Easter egg toward the Legends of the EU. I'm like, oh, that's probably true. That'd be great. And another guy was like, you guys are way overanalyzing this. It's just how they spell Jason in the Star Wars galaxy. And I'm like, I don't want to pour cold water on your theory, dude, because, I mean, from an anthropological standpoint, that's probably true. Sociologically speaking, it's just about the way they spell Jason, right? It's like there's so many ways to spell the name Sean, right? But I think there's more to it than that, because Jason Solo, majorly gifted in the Force, son of two great heroes from the Rebellion, falls to the dark side. Jason Syndulla, pretty gifted in the Force, son of two great heroes from the Rebellion. Uh-oh.
But at least both weren't in the Force, though. Though he's not super, so he can be beaten.
True.
And maybe he won't go down the path of what Ben Solo did. So.
But see, we're going to have Jason Syndulla be, you know, fighting age during the big Mandalorian movie that we're all expecting to be a retelling of Heir to the Empire. And if we're gonna have one of our heroes betray everybody, might it be lightsaber dude whose name is Jason? I don't want to say they're telegraphing anything.
I still think that'll be the cliffhanger that you'll get, or well, not cliffhanger since it's the end, but that's what we'll get early on in this season of Ahsoka 2. Will be that Ezra is actually a spy, and you'll be like, WTF? And then we'll find out at the end of the season that he was a clone the whole time.
Yeah, and we'll get some really creepy shot of the real Ezra frozen in carbonite back on.
Well, that's
Thrawn's
who
space.
Balin is going to go find.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I won't be mad if you're correct on that theory, but I'm sticking with. Oh, this guy's name is Jason, and his mom and dad were awesome heroes. And he loves lightsabers.
He can't be a bad guy.
This will be fine. Everything will be fine. There's no way this is going to go badly for the light side crew.
Could they then make Ezra the new Luke and make him?
Yeah, totally. Absolutely, I think that's what's going to happen. But I think we will
get
a Luke Skywalker clone. I think we will get Mara Jade in some series before the film comes out. But she'll be dark side through and through. And the culmination will be, you know, spoilers, you guys. I must kill Luke Skywalker, and it's going to happen just like it did in the book. She's going to kill Luke, but it's clone Luke. And then this will also be the method by which Maz Kanata acquires Anakin's lightsaber.
Could be happening. Or it could be Mara and Jason get together and just make it.
That would be. Yeah, I mean, it would still be a nice homage to the EU, to the Legends canon, because both of them were really important. Although for people like me, it'll be all, "Hi, he's kissing his aunt. I don't know if I can handle this." But then again, there's a Star Wars tradition there too, if you know what I'm saying. So you know, maybe Dave Filoni is like, "Listen, you guys, I learned from George Lucas, and I mean, this was on the Cliff Notes." Anyway. But if you guys want to see some cool Star Wars merchandise, why don't we do Derek's favorite part of the show? Speaking of, I collect action figures from the expanded universe. Derek, what Star Wars t-shirt are you wearing this week? Or do you have some other cool piece of merch?
I'm looking for something, because I'll be honest, I have like 8 or 9 new things to show you guys, but I have to watch them first.
Oh, boy.
Because Turtle T went on a massive clearance thing, so I got like everything super cheap, and they actually had a bunch of 2XL sizes. So
sweet.
They might still have the stuff going on sale. It was like, you know, but that was a couple weeks ago, so I don't know if they still have it, because I guess they were doing clearance. So, so I don't really have anything other than, here's a pretty picture of Anakin Skywalker as he's.
Yes,
there you go.
The eponymous Anakin Skywalker interrupt from the Star Wars CCG. We talked a lot about Solo, him, the man Han Solo, and then of course also his son and his daughter and his wife on our list here. So I am wearing a Solo shirt this time around from the Solo film from 2018. It's Han, Chewie, Lando, Kira, and the whole crew as they are doing their best old west gunfighter gangster impersonation as silhouettes in front of a setting sun out in the desert.
The most underrated Star Wars movies.
Absolutely. One of my favorite Star Wars movies ever, and one of my favorite motifs with the sun setting behind them. Plus, it's a red Star Wars shirt. You don't get a lot of those, other than the very famous Millennium Falcon cutaway, blueprint shirt. But I don't actually own that Millennium Falcon shirt, even though it had become somewhat of a cliche amongst collectors. So there you go.
I had it a long time ago, and I wore it.
Yeah, of course you did. Of course you did.
Too many pit stains on it, so I decided just to get rid of it. So I wore it too much. So
yeah,
I'd move on.
Well, if you guys out there want your own cool What a Piece of Junk t-shirt or pillow or mouse pad or any other merchandise from the shows here on the Fandom Podcast Network, please check us out over at thetpublic.com at the TeePublic store for the Fandom Podcast Network. And Derek, speaking of websites, where can people find the FPN out there on the interwebs?
So the fpnet.podbean.com is the master feed. So obviously download the Podbean app, or you can download us on any app podcast that you want, which would be Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and Google Play. Though I feel like I heard somewhere that Google Play is really trimming back on all their media stuff. So. But anyway,
I'll have to check into that.
So, but obviously check us out on the Facebook page that I run, What a Piece of Junk, a Star Wars podcast. The email that Scott alluded to earlier, What a Piece of Junk Pod at gmail.com, which he runs. The Twitter, which is kind of, who knows, I'm not sure. Kyle was still running it at What Wars, but it's really just the Instagram Fandom Podcast Network page where you can do that. And then again, any of the platforms that you download and listen to us or stream us, please leave us a review. 5 stars is preferred. But again, we'll take whatever because, again, you know, we got to help now pay for Nathan's medical bills. So, again, 5-star yes. reviews if you want to see Nathan back. If not, then that means you guys don't care enough about Nathan. And he may not show up on the next one now. I don't know. We got to get him to come back. So make sure he's medically cleared. So give us 5-star reviews. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. Well, anyway, we missed you very much this episode. Nathan, get well soon. But we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us for this longer-than-I-was-expecting episode. But you got me talking about Star Wars and books. Come on. Good times. I regret nothing. I thank you very much for joining us. Please let us know between shows what we can do to make it more enjoyable for you. And please always remember to respect each other and always respect each other's fandom. Well, Derek, I guess you're going to have to punch it.
Beep, boop, beep, boop, bop, bop.